Right, so what I'm going to do now is I'm going to defend my choice of subject, as is traditional with my talks, and try and point out the relevance of that footage that you've just seen to the theme of this year's summer school. Then I'm going to look briefly at both what the story of Coriolanus was and relate it to Shakespeare's sources. And then I'm going to discuss the apparent political inclinations of Shakespeare's version of the story, and look in particular at a key section that was actually omitted from that sequence, so a key part of the text, and talk about a little bit about why I think it's interesting that it's always omitted these days. And I'm going to look at the way that imagery is a part of protest and the way that the contest of image is part of one of the things that people struggle over when they protest. And then I'm going to look at the way some of the text is actually edited, because there's a little interesting, I find it interesting, you'll find it definitely dull, a little interesting factoid I discovered while I was doing a bit of reading up about this that I think is relevant. And then I'm going to look at the context of when the play was written and produced and how it was produced and performed. And I'm going to relate it to this area. I'm going to relate it to Birmingham and the history of this neck of the woods of the Midlands. And use that for both Shakespeare's text and the historical events in this area to look at a model of protest and how people protest and what is going on in protest, and in particular in relation to ideology and the reproduction and creation of ideology. And then I'll wrap it all up by saying it all again very quickly. So you saw the film sequence there. It was the producers, the directors said that they were trying to get a sort of like universal image of protest and of modern day violence, civic violence. And you can see that by the fact that they were able to use stock footage of several different bits of the world for the place called Rome. And as you can see in the handout sheet I've given you, I have to apologise, as I've said, there's only 23 sheets, not everyone will have one, but for those of you who have, I mean, it's just there, mostly it's here for me to quote bits from, but it's also there to, some of you were reading along, I could see, when you found the various bits that corresponded to the film there. And it starts off in the actual text. Enter Rome, a street. Enter a company of mutinous citizens with staves, clubs, and other weapons. That's Shakespeare's own words. Part of the point of discussing this is that this is presenting, I mean, the fact that they were able to find a story that was sort of modern and universal from this 400-year-old text, I think is telling and interesting. And in particular, because it was Shakespeare's own time, it was a 2,000-year-old story, more or less, that he was retelling. But he was telling it in the context of early modernity, when there was a massive city that was the central metropolis of the whole of England, to the extent that London created what's known as the Great Vowel Shift. And most of you from south of about here can tell the difference between could and bud, whereas I can't. Try it, you'll see. He was writing in a time when he understood where there were uprisings in the streets, and he understood them. And these uprisings and the form of them is fairly universal to city life. I mean, the idea of a massive crowd protesting in the streets can happen under any economic system. In any time in history, and particularly any time in which you have cities. So despite the fact that this is written pre-capitalism, there's still very strong resonances now. And we can see that that Shakespeare was aware of, was deliberately contemporary, or at least his mode of production was contemporary, because of anachronism. in other Roman plays, someone in Julius Caesar addresses people, says, "What are you doing out in the streets?" Being mechanicals, meaning being working folk, being craftsmen, and therefore they should be in the workshops. And at some point in the play, Coriolanus, the guy Martius you saw there at the start, his name changes during the play, describes that crowd you saw there as apron men. Again, so a telling anachronism that Shakespeare was writing about the city he knew and the time he knew about it. And he's page 86, I have to find it in the book. And of course, even in the first scene, we're told that the citizens, when they were going about the campaign against starvation, sighed forth proverbs that hunger broke stone walls, that dogs must eat, that meat was made for mouths, that the gods sent not corn for rich men only. With these shreds they vented their complainings. That's Coriolanus' own description of it. But it's clear this idea that with this sighed forth proverbs, he was aware that that was kind of the standard process by which people in his own day protested. And of course, nowadays we wouldn't call them proverbs. We'd say that, people put up slogans. They have chants, like they chanted bread. We know fairly accurately that the text that Shakespeare was borrowing was Plutarch's Lives. The text of the play, it follows very closely Plutarch's description. Now, Plutarch was writing, I forgot to check this out exactly, I think in the 1st century BC. But the story of Coriolanus itself is set in the very earliest days of the Roman Republic. So just a bit of context, this is not the time of Julius Caesar, this is about 500 BC. So literally 400 years before Plutarch wrote, and for him it was already kind of a time long, long ago. It wasn't contemporary history by any stretch of the imagination. And the Romans, according to the legend, threw over their kings the Tarquins. And they had various wars against Tarquin. Doesn't sound very ferocious, the Tarquins. but apparently they were. And according to Plutarch, after these various wars, the Roman citizens came back and they were starving. And there was dearth in the land, and there was all sorts of, all the animals on the face of the earth can get something to eat and yet men can't. That was the sort of proverbs that they sighed forth. And at that time, the plebeians, actually, and Shakespeare doesn't mention this in his version of the story, the plebeians threatened to just leave the city and go and set up a new city of their own. At which point the patricians and the Senate bought them off and gave them the tribunes, popular representatives to represent the will of the people. You can read about this story in much more depth. There's a pamphlet by the American impossibilist Daniel De Leon, 2 pages from Roman History, in which he recounts it with his own very particular slant and take on that story. And that's part of, the reason of this, is that these stories from Rome have been dug up time and again, and people do use them in very direct, contemporary political ways to make their point. So it's not just dry as dust stuff. Now, the story itself, there's very little historical source to say it ever happened. Coriolanus himself, the story goes, he rose up, he wanted to be consul. The people rejected him because they thought he would restore tyranny and he would get rid of the nascent democracy and the tribunes. So they drove him out of the city. And I'm not spoiling the plot for you, by the way, because we want to show the film later, but I just useful to tell you what happened. And he allies himself with the enemies of Rome and comes back. And it's only the intervention of his mother that stops him from sacking the city with, it's either pronounced Volscians or Volscians, it depends on the production, or who knows more about Latin pronunciation. But it's clearly something out of hero myth. I mean, some writers I've seen say that his name, Caius Martius, isn't a proper Roman name. It doesn't make sense in terms of how Romans built their name. So it's clearly the name like Martius, Mars, war. He's some sort of epitome of a warrior. and of a nobleman and of the true heroic patriot, patriotic spirit, who is eventually undone by the certainly in Shakespeare's version by the intriguing of political schemers, in particular the tribunes, who decide that they want to use the people to defend the position that they've won for themselves. And it's clear from that take and from this indication what Shakespeare's on view. In the 18th century, sort of early 19th century critic, liberal critic, William Hazlitt, said that Shakespeare seemed to incline towards the absolute. And I think that's a fairly reasonable way of looking at it. He sides with Martius. It's clear Martius is or Coriolanus, is a hero, he's a patriot, he's a fine warrior. He's just undermined by his tragic flaw that he can't soft-soak the people, and he believes that he deserves power and honours because of his own right, because he's fought these wars and been wounded, and it's so self-evidently obvious that he deserves it. He doesn't need to wait on anyone else's opinion. And that's kind of what the crux of Shakespeare's story is. Other critics have described Shakespeare's writing generally as asking radical questions and then providing conservative answers. And there's no doubt that Shakespeare himself was probably fairly conservative, possibly still a Catholic when he died. And he was, by the time he wrote this, a landowner. He was, and of course, the writers of that day existed by patronage. He wrote for the king's men. You know, this guy depended on courtly prestige. So it's very unlikely that he would be an actual radical. But the idea that he was asking, not just providing radical conservative answers to conservative pastiches of radical questions, he was asking the radical question, means that they can be read in a way that is quite radical. And at the very least, you can open up the radical question and see that revealed in its own light. There's another bit of evidence, which is that in Shakespeare's writings, particularly his Roman plays, there's something of a convention that the fickle crowd is always swayed by the last speaker to address them. So, famously in Julius Caesar, Brutus comes out and addresses the crowd and then says, "And now I leave you with Mark Antony to address you." And suddenly Mark Antony goes, yeah, bit of a slag, Brutus. Let's go get him." And the crowd turn from one side to the other instantly. And you can see sort of this in action in the text I provided. Now, what happens here, just for those who don't have a copy in front of you, is the guy played by Brian Cox there, good Senator Menenius, turns up and he addresses the crowd and he tells them that the senators have their best interests at heart, the patricians care for them. And obviously for Shakespeare, patricians, he uncritically reads as the aristocracy. I mean, they weren't aristocracy in the sense that he would have understood it. And Menenius plays with the first citizen here. So he starts to tell the story of the belly. Now, this story is taken straight from Plutarch, and it's clearly one of the reasons that he wanted to use this text, because this is straight from it. And he basically says, there was a time when all the body's parts rebelled against the stomach. Say, well, stomach, you're bloody useless. You're a great big hole at the centre. You know, what do you do? We all do all the really useful stuff, and then you just sit there with all the food in you. You greedy bastard. I'm paraphrasing. Yeah, Shakespeare wrote like that. And you can see that in the way it goes on, that Menenius is clearly winning the argument, because he strings First Citizen along by going First Citizen to say, well, what did he answer? What did he say? And then he eventually turns around and says, the stomach said, well, look, I only store the food. I pass it round to all of you. You all get food because I give it you. And the first citizen then says, it was an answer, how you apply this? Menenius says, the senators of Roma, this good belly, and you, the mutinous members, for examine their counsels and their cares, digest things rightly touching the will of the common. You shall find no public benefit which you receive, but it proceeds from them to you, and no way from yourselves. And then he proceeds to start abusing. Now, that's clearly a hoary old chestnut. And in fact, possibly it was probably slightly more true, given what we know of the behaviour of tribal cultures and early Roman culture. Probably was true that to be a patrician, you had to give massive, very popular feasts, and you had to give a lot of your food away and wealth away in order to win the support of the population. And that happens in a lot of societies. It doesn't have to happen in an aristocracy. So even by Shakespeare's time, this is a horribly anachronistic story. And Shakespeare seems to be aware of this, because has Menenius, before he starts out, saying, "I'll steal it some more." So clearly this hoary old chestnut of a parable that's, you know, put out there to justify the rule of the elite, clearly had done the rounds, and, you know, presumably everyone knew it. But even so, if you look at, despite this convention that the crowd always swayed, you still have first citizens say, it was an answer, how you apply this. He clearly doesn't sound, to me, convinced. Maybe Shakespeare was aware that the protesters knew it was a hoary old chestnut and weren't buying it then. But of course, the reason why I had to had put it in a handout, as you saw in the film there, this sequence is almost always cut. You know, they haven't put the play down. It's a bit on the long side, and for some strange reason, they just assume that modern audiences are just not going to buy the parable of the belly, and that anyone watching it will just go, well, they're not going to buy it either. And just wouldn't believe that it would placate them in the way that would be expected of a Shakespeare story. But also, you saw in the version they had there, and apparently in other versions, this is a quite common tactic, when Coriolanus turns up, he turned up with a squad of soldiers. Now, it doesn't say anything about a squad of soldiers in the text, but what it does say is it has Menenius say, he breaks off. "But make you ready your stiff bats and clubs. Roman harass at the point of battle. The one side must have bail." Now, again, enter Caius Marcius. What I would say about him in terms of the actual myth is, this is heroic myth. This is the time when, you know, he's like Achilles. He's like Gilgamesh. He's like Cú Chulainn of the Irish stories. He could beat them all up. So even if you don't assume that he has an army turned up, the assumption is that Coriolanus on his own could have the lot of them. So that there is clearly somewhere in there that this confrontation that I've presented between Septimius and the mutinous plebeians breaks off by the violent intervention of the state and of the patrician class. But even so, it's clear that there is a great deal of power in the corporate image presented by the parable of the belly. And it's one that comes back time and time again, which is that society is a human body, of which we are all parts and members. In fact, member, you know, that's a member, it's a limb. That's what the word means. So when we're all the members of society, we are the limbs of it. The corporate imagery runs fairly deep into our language. And this corporate imagery is contested throughout the play. At some point, Sicinius and Brutus, the two tribunes, describe Coriolanus as a diseased limb which has to be cut off. And Menenius replies, no, he's just a limb which is diseased and which can be cured. So they contest through the medium of this corporate imagery, of literally the body politic. And page 113. That's where I put my mark. Right. Now, this is someone called Third Citizen, and I'll discuss the citizen numbers in a wee moment. "Ingratitude is monstrous, and for the multitude to be ungrateful were to make a monster of the multitude, of which we, being members, should bring ourselves to be monstrous members." Now, a bit Shakespeare, a bit. I think that's a knob gag. Very likely. But, you know, it's, again, he's subtly insulting them. I mean, this sort of tortured logic chopping is usually a sign of a clown. You know, and someone coming up with a bad pun at the end of it. Obviously, he's making light of the common citizenry and the tortuous logic that they go through. the reply to this is that Coriolanus struck not to call us the many-headed multitude. Though Citizen replies, we have been called so of many. Not that our heads are some brown, some black, some auburn, some bald, but that our wits are so diversely coloured. And truly I think, if all our wits were to issue out of one skull, they would fly east, west, north, south, and their consent of one direct way should be at once to all points of the compass. I mean, it doesn't come much clearer than that way, which way Shakespeare is inclined, that people severally cannot agree on anything, and that ultimately the body politic has to rely on a single will. And we do get something of that slightly later, when Coriolanus, now he's talking about, at this point, he's in deep conflict between the patricians and the plebeians, who have decided that they don't want him to be their consul, to be the president, as it were. This double worship, where one part does disdain with cause, the other insult without all reason, where gentry title wisdom cannot conclude but by the yea and no of general ignorance, it must omit real necessities and give way the while to unstable slightness. Purpose so barred, it follows, nothing is done to purpose. And so this is kind of the underlying message or underlying thought, which is that the several people can't organise themselves, and if we can't have a single clear voice coming from the top directing everything, then there will be nothing done to purpose. Everything will just be the random fickleness of the mob. And as we heard him say on the telly there, they sit by the fire and presume to know what's done in the capital, who's like to rise, who thrives and who declines, side factions and give out conjectural marriages, making parties strong and feebling such as stand not in their liking below their cobbled shoes. Again, another anachronism. Romans did not have cobbled shoes. Now, into this situation, I would like to bring the curious case of the second citizen. Now, you'll see in the sheet that I've got in front of you that all the lines are given to first citizen. Now, as it so happened, I was reading around and I happened to have access to a library that has a facsimile edition of the first folio of Shakespeare's works. That's the standard. That's the only version, the standard that we know, the earliest copy of this particular play. Some plays have what's known as quarto versions that vary slightly, and so you'll sometimes see in the textual notes, if you've ever had to read a Shakespeare play at school or anything, they go, in this version it says this. Now, there's about 450, actually, apparently, quarto folio copies of the complete works of Shakespeare in the world, and someone has just gone out and visited them all and brought out a fairly serious tome describing them all and where they are and who's got them in the state. And they actually found about 25 that have been missing for a long while. So the folio play. Now, throughout, these lines are given to second citizen. Now, what happens is, you saw at the start there, I'll fish up my copy and go to the start, you saw the two political agitators, the first one saying, let's kill Coriolanus, or kill Gaius Marcius, and then we shall have grain at our own pricing. And the other one say, well, first citizen, we kill him. Would you proceed especially against Gaius Marcius? Second citizen, consider you what services he has done for his country. Do not speak maliciously of him. And throughout, second citizen defends Coriolanus against first citizen. But then it's second citizen who does all the talking with Senator Menenius. Now, what happened was, sometime in the 18th century, an editor called White decided that didn't make dramatic sense. And he decided that to swap them over and say, well, first citizen is clearly the radical, and second citizen is much more of a moderate, and therefore decided to give all of those lines to first citizen. Now, the point isn't that he was necessarily wrong in doing that. I just think it happens to be particularly fascinating, but it also shows an ideological bent, that the crowd must be divided, even if it is more dramatically pleasing, and I'm not going to make any judgment on that particular point, whether it is or not. There's clearly a mental process, an ideological process at the back there that makes it more dramatically pleasing to have this division in the crowd, whereas other writers have said, well, actually, it actually makes a kind of sense that the second citizen is still a member of the mob and is still a radical. And in fact, I mean, there is no evidence either way. All we know is we have the evidence of the first folio, which says second citizen. Now, it could be, my pet theory is that Shakespeare wasn't particularly fussed with his citizen numbering. And what he means by first citizen, second is a citizen, another citizen, and another. It's not particularly, they're not characters, they're just voices in the crowd. You could actually probably have three or four different ones, although with this sequence here of the back and forth with Menenius, I think you probably would have to have just one person doing it. But even still, it's an interesting ideological shift that people want there to be divisions between radicals and moderates, as it would be in today's news parlance. Right, so having gone from the curious case of second citizen to the history of the book of Shakespeare, we can come now to the time that Shakespeare was writing Coriolanus. Now, they reckon Coriolanus was written in 1608. There's lots of textual evidence that suggests this. In the sequence that you've got in front of you, Coriolanus says at some point, "You're no more sure than the fire on the ice." Well, there was the Thames froze over in 1605, so we have a kind of a date of a time at the very least. And the copy of Plutarch that Shakespeare used came out again at another date, so the English translation of it. Now, it also so happens that in 1608. I put these in the wrong order. That's what happened in 1608. Various broadside ballads were produced. One of them was called "A Just Complaint Made by the Poor of England Against the Covetous Greedy Firmers, Which Cause a Dearth of Plentiful Fingers." And there was a counter broadside, or a similar one, "Exhorting all sinners to require God's commiseration and mercy for the great famine and plague, which at this instant we justly suffer." Yes. Now, in fact, there had been several uprisings the title I've got here is of an article is "Imagine an Insurrection in 17th Century England, Representations of the Midland Rising of 1607. And there was a rising. It was generally around, I thought I underlined all of these things so I didn't lose them. That was useless of me, wasn't it? Well, the rising was around Northamptonshire, Warwickshire, and basically around the Midland area. And in fact, one of the things that intrigued me when I was reading through the copies of Coriolanus and looking at the notes was some of these groups, some of them were referred to as the Warwickshire Diggers of 1607, who, according to Steve Hindle here, sometimes referred to themselves as levellers. Now, what happened was that there were illegal enclosures, or what these diggers presumed to be illegal enclosures. So what was happening was the common land was being enclosed and turned into pasture for sheep, because this is the beginning of the whole process of the people were cleared from the land, sheep replaced them, and the cotton merchants and the wool merchants feed all of this. And this is, I'm right to think, sorry, I just remembered another talk that I referenced in my previous one. This is all about it. I can feed this story all the way back to the Silk Road if I try. But at this time, they were enclosing the land. And what happened was these Warwickshire diggers, these levellers, they went out and they said, "Well, this is wrong. We're being thrown out of our villages. We can't live on the land anymore." And they dug up the enclosed land and began to work it. They were led by a character called John Rennell, reputedly a peddler or a tinker by trade, and he became known as Captain Pouch. Now, he was called Captain Pouch because of a leather satchel, which he claimed contained sufficient matter to defend them against all comers. Now, as it so happens, about a crowd of 1,000 men and women were busy digging up the enclosure in Newton in June 1607 when the Earl of Shrewsbury turned up with his armed forces and he jobbed them good. He told them that the king had said, "No, this is good. It's a seditious libel to say that this is an unlawful enclosure. I've got the king's warrant. We're going to come and get you." By June the 8th, he summarily executed two of the digger leaders under martial law. And they read the proclamation out. When they wouldn't, they refused. They stood their ground. They fought desperately, but at the second charge, they ran away. And a rout, some 40 or 50 of them were slain, and a very great number hurt. Many more were apprehended, and several were subsequently executed, either after due process at a special judicial commission convened in Northampton, or summarily executed under martial law under the terms of another royal proclamation. The quartered, and this is Steve Newton's own words, the quartered carcasses of the guilty men were exhibited at Northampton, Oundle, Thrapston, and other places, which suggests, he suggests, means that there was some sympathy for this crowd of several thousand in these nearby towns. And it was this was the culmination of 6 weeks of disorder across the three counties of Leicestershire, Northamptonshire, and Warwickshire. And he says that it should be known really as the Midland Rising rather than the Midland Revolt. And it certainly seems to have been sufficiently widely spread. Now, what he suggests in his account is that what these diggers were doing was that they were enacting a mockery of officialdom. They were doing what they thought the law ought to be doing anyway. They said the law is against enclosure. We're doing what the king would do if he was here. That was their way of thinking. And apparently Reynolds told them to be studious and polite and to be calm and civil and orderly. So this was a peaceful direct action protest. They were digging up the enclosed land that was robbing them and starving them. And the next year there was a dearth of corn as well. So Shakespeare owned land in Warwickshire. How close to these uprisings it was isn't clear, but he would have certainly been aware that he was one of the people that they didn't like, and they were the people who were protesting. So it struck very close to home for him. In this mockery then of officialdom, we have a kind of idea of a model of protest. So I've already said how we have these disputed signs and the disputed images, and now we have this idea of disputed official action. This is the right thing to do. And when people protest, they are telling power, this is what you should be doing. They're disputing the signs of power, and they're contesting what should be the law, literally. Or in most cases, also, I mean, when people, there's list about the rights of war, people are disputing how the law should be interpreted, and whether they go, that's a war crime, and the power goes, no, that's not a war crime, we've said it's not. These are points of where disputes come along and where the slogans come out and how they try and contest for power. But what they sometimes don't recognise is that when they're contesting within the terms of the language of power, when they're contesting within the terms of saying, well, if the king was here, this is what the king would do, they're forgetting that the king is a man-made object, that the king is something that is created. It's not something that's beyond it. They're missing out the stage whereby someone has had to produce the law, the king, the system. And that is the stage that hides behind. And it's the stage that moves beyond protest to finding out that the king is man-made, to moving beyond disputing and saying, well, actually, we're going to stand outside this whole system of symbols and signs, and we're going to do things for ourselves. That you move beyond protest to revolution, essentially. That is the step beyond by which... And, of course, I mean, the most common one we would say these days is money. People say, you know, we need money for this, we need money for that, and they dispute where the tokens, where the signs, where the words, you know, I will pay the bearer on the demand the sum of £5. That's the words that they're arguing over. But then they miss out the fact that there is a system that this money had to be created by human beings, and they're just working within a humanly created machine. As it turned out, within a few years after this bloody suppression, which the author of the article says, is strangely stricken from the record. It's very... I've never heard of the Warwickshire Diggers or the Midland Uprising, and it's off the list of Tudor uprisings and the like. But, I mean, 50 people died just over down the road. You know, a horrible pitched battle. Within a few years, they learned the lesson, and they changed the law to stop the enclosures for a little while. And they made it so it had to be done through an act of parliament. But that was them realising that the change in the law was harmful. And of course, what they couldn't be afford to do was to be seen to be backing down to the common tag, as Coriolanus would have it. So what I've tried to do is I've tried to show how Shakespeare's play has been adapted in this modern version, and how, because it's setting its anachronistic eternal city, it is relevant to today's process. And I've tried to show that Shakespeare was erring on the side of aristocracy and absolutism, but that he couldn't avoid the radical questions that were being asked, because he had to represent accurately to a contemporary audience the protests that were going on and that everyone would have in the room would have known about. Incidentally, I should say, at first I thought he would have had a problem, because if it was presented at the Globe, you'd have had the Groundling Pit and he would have to be talking to them. But it turns out this was one of the first plays produced at the Jacobean Theatre, indoor theatre, that they're now rebuilding. So this would have been produced indoors to the much more select and refined sort of people who could afford an indoor theatre on a winter's night. So this is him talking to the gentry and the middling sort. But even still, he had to ask the radical questions to provide the conservative answers. And I've looked at the imagery within the text and the way in which the dispute is presented there, and I've looked at the historical struggle that he was aware of, and in particular the Warwickshire Diggers. And I've tried to put that towards a model of ideology and protest that I think can be seen to underpin all of this. Ah, and I promised you mouldy cheese. And yes, well, you've all guessed it. When they opened up Captain Pouch's pouch. And I think somewhere there's a lesson for us in that. Thank you.